listening to Soccer Matters on ESPN 97.5. From the Gau Studios in Houston, here's Glenn Davis.
All right, welcome back to Soccer Matters on ESPN 97.5. We roll on here in what is the holiday season, and no better than to get Julie Foudy on this show. Julie, thank you very much for joining us.
Hi, Glenn.
All right, so happy holidays first and foremost. I know you've been all over the country here in recent times. There's a lot of topics to go over. Let's start off first with the career of Abby Wambach, her retirement. You called the game the other night and what she's meant for the women's game.
Oh, gosh, how many days do we have, Glenn? You don't have enough time for that. Anyone who's seen her play, you see the passion. You see that she just, her heart's beating out of her chest. And that's what I've always loved about Abby is, a teammate and then as someone, who we are lucky enough to call games and have watched her career for so long. And that actually is why I'm so excited about what she'll do next, because this is a woman who, when she breaks a leg in the final send-off game right before the 2008 Olympics, which causes her, of course, to miss that Olympics. She handles it with incredible grace and courage and comes back and breaks the scoring record and goes on to set all these great records. And when she lost the World Cup and the, penalty kicks to 2011 and she still hadn't won her coveted World Cup that she always talked about, she handled it again with such grace. And so it's that mentality that we see in life of successful people that, regardless of what's thrown at them, even if they fall, they stumble, whatever the obstacle is, they're going to carry on. And that's what made her so good on the soccer field. And I think what will make her so good in this next adventure.
99 World Cup winner, Julie Foudy, joining us on the program here. And I've been very fortunate over the years to be able to call games with Julie on ESPN. Hey, we've done what? We've done MLS. We've done the women's national team. We've done the NWSL. We pretty much have covered the gamut. The NCAA women's game, huh?
We have. We've done a lot.
We've had a great time doing it.
Together a lot.
Yep.
We've been cruising the country in this December holiday time.
We have been living large. Let's just put it that way. let me take you back to the NCAA Women's College Cup that we called this year. Does the college game continue to just reach different levels when it comes to individual players and then the overall play of teams tactically?
Yeah, and I think especially because that was the sixth different team to win in the last 6 years. And for the women's side of things, as we know in women's soccer, I mean, if it's not UNC, it's been a surprise, right, over the last few decades. So that parity is a big step forward. And it's so fun. I love to call it because you're getting a glimpse at, what our national team is going to have on it. And you're getting to see players and you're getting to see the future of the sport. So I think it's a healthy development. And when you see teams like Penn State winning the first, and a Rutgers, getting into their first Final Four, upsetting Virginia on penalty kicks and just battling through it. I think that's a healthy thing for the game, for sure.
Yeah, Erica Walsh and Penn State, very impressive in that tournament. Rutgers was in it. Florida State was the defending national champions, upset by Duke, who really changed things around during their regular season, played a counterattacking style and a deep defending style that they couldn't break down. It was an exceptional night. And I'm going to take it back to Abby again now. With her retiring from the women's national team, and maybe that had already begun in the Women's World Cup, what does the future look like without her?
Well, I think you're going to, the hard thing for Coach Ellis is she doesn't have much time in terms of a turnaround between big events with the Olympics happening in August and qualifiers for that, in February, so a month and a half away. So I think she'll probably bring in one or two new kids for qualifiers, and probably Crystal Dunn and Lindsay Horan, and then then she'll have a stretch of 6 months where she can look a little bit more, but it's a shortened roster. I just can't see her making huge changes. And the good news for the U.S. is they've got, with how many girls we have playing in this country, of course we have a large pool to choose from. So even with the greatest goal scorer on the planet retiring, you know, you've got a crop of talent behind her that could fill those shoes. I think the challenge is, you know, who fills the role in terms of that emotional leader and that passion she brings to the game. And where we've seen her do it time and time again, she just takes the team and says, get on my back, let's go. You know, who's going to be that person? We saw Carly Lloyd do it in the World Cup. Can she fill that void alone? I think that's asking an awful lot. I think you're going to have a couple players step up into that role.
Stylistically, purpose of play, does much change? I mean, obviously she brings an aerial dimension that no other person can in the world when she's in the game. Does it mean the game is different with Carly Lloyd now as a focal point running the team?
Yeah. Well, I mean, you obviously don't have that threat in the air, to your point, of with Abby on the field, you know, things definitely get more direct and they start sliding balls in. But I also think that could be something that was a detriment to them and, you know, in her final few years where she wasn't going to be chasing balls into channel. So if you wanted Abby on the field, you had to play a different game. And it forced them into a more direct game, which I don't think suits them as well. So maybe in the end, you know, I would never say it's a good thing when you have a player like Abby retiring, but maybe in the end it forces them to figure out, okay, we've got to get better in that final third with our front seven and how we figure that out.
Talk to me about Abby, because in this recent podcast she did, she weighed in on a lot of subjects. She's obviously somebody that people want to hear from. She's obviously somebody that's going to have an opinion on everything. But on one hand, I kind of heard her saying, well, I'm going to kind of disappear and I'm off social media. And then on the other hand, I hear her, she's a strong-willed person with opinions. I just can't see that going away. I think that's going to resurface. That's my opinion. Yours.
Yeah, no, she's not going away. I mean, I think that that whole social media, you know, deleting her Twitter handle was part of that Gatorade Forget Me campaign. I don't know if you saw that commercial.
Oh, okay.
But there was actually a really cool commercial where the whole thing, it was her kind of in the locker room for the last time, and she had voiced it, and it was her saying, essentially what she said to me in that sit-down we did for SportsCenter was, you know, I don't want them talking about me, right, when I'm gone. I want them talking about the next stud on the U.S. team, like an Alex Morgan or a Crystal Dunn or whoever it is, but I want them to forget me because – you know, I don't want it to be about me. I want to be a legend, sure, but I want them to grow and keep progressing. And so that was this whole orchestrated campaign where she shut down her media channels around the, I think, the Forget Me campaign. But she'll be back. This is a woman we once gave a T-shirt to, Glenn, that said, help, I'm talking and I can't shut up. Right? She can't help herself. She'll be back.
Yeah, I didn't think she was going anywhere. Julie Foudy joining us. Also one of the most humble people you'll ever meet in your life. Wonderful to work with on all these games. I've been very fortunate. So I'm going to continue on with Alex Morgan. She's played a lot of games on artificial surface. She certainly has to be considered somewhat injury-prone right now. You would have to say part of her career has been defined by injuries. Are you worried about her when it comes to an injury standpoint in the future?
Yeah, I think you have to be, you know, given the last few years she's had, where she's basically since 2012, you know, she's just been battling one thing or another. And so, and it's pretty obvious she doesn't like playing on those artificial surfaces, given some of the issues that she's had with it being in her ankle and her knee. So, and I don't blame her at all. I think that was another point of contention with, you know, 8 of the 10 victory tour games on turf. So I think with Alex, her big goal this year is I got to get minutes. I got to get time. I got to get my confidence back in front of goal because we obviously know what she can do with her speed and her finishing touch. But it's hard, as you know, Glenn, mentally when you're constantly fighting to get back, and especially some of the injuries she had, which was a bone bruise in her foot that just took months and months, and it just kept, you know, it was like, oh, she's not back for another 2 months, and then another 3 months, and that just takes a toll on you mentally and physically. But I think she's going to be happy to hear that this entire next year, U.S. Soccer has promised every game will be on grass going into this Olympics.
Wow. That's a big piece, isn't it? And that's a real testament to people, well, really the players and the women really speaking out on the issue of artificial surface.
Yeah, and unfortunately, though, you know, as you've heard me say before, you know, I don't think they should have ever been put in that position to have to speak out like that. I think that was a terrible position to be put in. And when you hear from the players and others about the state of that field, no, that just should never happen. And even people in football and Pro Bowler types who have covered, you know, the Pro Bowl for years say, you know, that's a legendary mess of a field. So U.S. soccer, you know, should have sent someone. I would have gone. I would have raised my hand, Glenn, and done that duty for the U.S. Soccer Federation. Take me to Hawaii, but that should never happen where the players have to step up and say, hey, this isn't safe, and we got to protect our careers, our livelihoods. And the Olympic qualifiers only being 2 months away. It's crazy when you think about it.
How do you think U.S. soccer handled that? Because, you know, obviously that was a slightly embarrassing moment there because we all know that field is not good. I've been out there. You could have made a phone call to somebody in Hawaii to check it out for you. I mean,
yeah. I think actually Sunil and U.S. soccer handled it well. I mean, I think I was afraid they were going to push it back on the players and make them bad guys in all of this. But I think they took the blame and said, look, we screwed up here. You know, and they even went in front of the players. Jay Berhalter came out from U.S. Soccer because Sunil was at MLS Cup and basically apologized to the team in person and said, you know, we're sorry. This will never happen again. We messed up here. So I think the players, I think that went a long way to the players because obviously you can imagine their frustration having to speak out like that. And, you know, they wanted to play for those fans and thinking about all the people who traveled there or who were in Hawaii who had never seen the team. So I think actually they handled it well. The thing that I am frustrated by is, you know, U.S. soccer for the women's side is the standard bearer for women's soccer everywhere in the world. I mean, they do more to support and fund and develop and players in this country than anywhere else. So to have that be something that's so avoidable, so public, and look so bad and reflect so poorly on them, I think is just sloppy by Sunil and his crew.
Well, listen, your group in 99, I think, affected women's sport around the world. I don't think there's any question. That's one of the great things that team and the individuals on it, like yourself, really sent an amazing message around the world. But before I get into that, I want to continue on with the artificial surface. We all know the link to obviously joint injuries, those kind of things. There's a lot of debilitating stuff that goes on there. But even one step further, you did and I know you spent a lot of time traveling around doing research interviews for your ESPN E60 piece on artificial surfaces. Just shed a little bit of light on that, because this was all about the rubber pellets and carcinogens that are in them that can potentially cause illness. So take us a little bit through that. Give us the Cliff Notes version of, number one, all the work you did, because I know you put extensive research into it, but then what the findings were.
Yeah. I mean, it's a story I covered for a good year. I've never put that much work or time or energy into anything I've done in my life. And, you know, the more you dig into it and you look at the different synthetic turf fields around the country, and specifically we were looking at the crum rubber fields, the ones with the black pellets that you mentioned, the thing that stands out is there's a list that's being collected by a goalkeeper coach who I actually played on the national team with. Amy Allman was her name when she played with the U.S. team. She was on the 91 World Cup team, but she is now Amy Griffin, and is the goalkeeper and co-head coach at University of Washington. But anyways, she obviously lives in Seattle, coaches there. She's coached there for the last 20 years. And she said, hey, look, I'm surrounded by goalkeepers all the time, right? This is my life. This is what I do. I train them at camps. I train young kids around here. And 20 years ago, I never came across a goalkeeper who had cancer. And there came a point about 10 years ago, it wasn't quite 10 years ago, it was more like 2009, I think, is when she first started thinking about it. She said, you know, all these goalkeepers that I knew were coming down with cancer. And two of them, these two women in particular, said, Amy, we just think something's up with that black turf, those dots. And so I think it triggered something, this red flag in Amy's mind. And literally she would go to the University of Washington Hospital, the Seattle Children's Hospital next door. And she said one of the nurses, when she was hooking up an IV to a goalkeeper with cancer, said, oh, my gosh, you're a goalkeeper? You're the fourth goalkeeper I've hooked up this week to an IV.
Jeez.
And Amy said the hairs on the back of my neck just stood up. And she said, I just started collecting names. And now, you know, and her list was small at first. And now that was in 2009. And now she's at 200 athletes. 100 and I have to go over my numbers again. About one, so 200 athletes, about 185 of them are soccer players. And of those 185, two-thirds of them are goalkeepers. And they all are athletes who have played on turf. That's the one common denominator. So when you start looking at what's in that turf, which is what we did in our story, it becomes a little bit frightening, because tires they couldn't get rid of. They can't put them in landfills because when they burn, they're toxic. They burn forever. I mean, there's all these reasons why they're a special hazardous waste. And so the EPA, our federal government, decided if we shred them up into fine particles and put them on surfaces where kids play, it's a good way to recycle this waste in all these scrap tires. And, you know, at the time, it seemed like a good idea. But now when you look at it and you look at all the carcinogens in tires, known carcinogens, and there's over 250 chemicals, many of them they don't even know that are in tires, many that have been proven to be harmful, it starts to become less and less of a good idea. So we talk about the science some, but we mostly talk about, you know, the stories of these families and some of the heartache they've dealt with. Just trying to deal with it. And we talked to a lot of scientists, a lot of different people who deal with it, obviously, on a daily basis. But it's heart-wrenching. It's sad when you think about it, because if there is something wrong with these fields, then they're everywhere now, Glenn, as you know. And you track them into your house, and they're in your bed sheets when you go to bed, and you have stories of goalkeepers pulling them out of their eyes, you know, the next day thinking it's sleep. So, it's going to be a hard one to deal with, I think, and which I think is part of the problem.
And the carcinogens are ingested by airborne particles when they're diving to the ground, all of this stuff.
Yeah. Well, see, the thing is, and which is why the turf industry will tell you, there's no study that's been done that says it's not harmful, which is technically true, but scientists will then admit that there are huge data gaps, meaning there are areas they haven't looked at. So what they've done is they've taken an air sample, right, of a field or right above the field, and they've done kind of an atmospheric study. But what they haven't looked at well enough, which all the scientists agree to, is they haven't looked at what they call absorption. So through your cuts, right, as we know, you take that top layer of skin off, you get that terrible rug burn, and then the goalkeepers are diving in it, and it's in their elbows and they're pulling, the pellets out of these cuts. They're pulling them out of their mouth. They're pulling them out of their eyes. So they haven't looked at absorption, and they haven't studied the effects of that. They know that this black stuff is full of bad things. It's just whether it's at a level that is dangerous. And that's where I actually, as a parent with kids who play on it, got frustrated, because I said, then there's bad stuff in there. Why not at least tell us to wash our hands after we use it, right? Why not at least alert us that, hey, we don't know. This is what we're not sure of. It could or it could not, but this is what's in there. We're still testing it. But there's no warning signs. There's no one talking about it. If you go to the turf industry website, they say they are 100% sure it's safe. And I think that's disingenuous.
Well, they will until it's proved otherwise.
What's that, Glenn?
I said they will until it's proved otherwise.
Right.
That is disingenuous.
Of course, because if you start putting warning signs up, right, what are parents going to start doing? Wait a second. What is this? What do you mean it's not safe? Why hasn't anyone told me this?
And we all know a lot of money is made,
honestly,
in the artificial surface industry.
I keep thinking, oh, the government says it's fine. It must be fine. But the government has just really retreated into a position of saying nothing, because they're the ones who endorsed it in the first place, right? So now how do you say, I'm not sure about this, actually. So it's complicated. There's so many layers to it. But the one thing I want people to be aware of is that we should at least be aware there is some bad stuff in there. And if your kids are playing on it, wash your hands and wash yourself after you're done with it. Do not be having picnics on that stuff.
No doubt about it. Julie, listen, I want to wish you and your family very happy holidays. Great work on that piece, and I think shedding the light on it is amazing. I know the concerns are still growing around this whole thing with the artificial surface and the link to the crumb rubber pellets. Thank you again for all that work, and also thanks for a great year. Enjoyed doing the games with you, and look forward to next year.
Awesome, Glenn. You too, buddy. Have a great holiday.
All right. Thank you, Julie. That's Julie Foudy, 99, World Cupper. And think about that team, that win, and what that did to the perception of not only women's soccer, but women's athletics around the world. We'll take a break here, 7-Up break. More to come.
ESPN 97.5. You are listening to Soccer Matters on ESPN 97.5. From the Gao Studios in Houston, here's Glenn Davis.
All right, welcome back to Soccer Matters here on ESPN 97.5. Hey, a quick word here for Bud Light. Bud Light reminds you, this is the season for giving. Good stocking stuffers, the Houston Dash tickets, Houston Dynamo tickets. Get people down to BBVA Compass Stadium, like-minded individuals who love the game. Plus, we've got all kinds of international content rolling through Houston. Bud Light reminds you, take part in being a fan at the beautiful BBVA Compass Stadium. And as always, our thanks to Bud Light. And with that, what a great opportunity here for the first time to get BBVA Compass Stadium and Houston Dynamo partner Jake Silverstein, one of the new owners, a private investor based in Portland, Oregon. He joins us now. Jake, thank you very much for coming on the show.
Oh, thanks so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, and I know you're coming off a little bit of a tough surgery, so we also thank you for making the time for us right now, because I know it's been a little bit painful for you.
Yeah, you know, it could be worse. I'll be back at full steam, hopefully in time for opening day, although I won't be on the pitch, but hopefully I'll be able to travel and be there to watch.
All right, so let's talk first. I think one thing my listeners will really want to know is, hey, Jake Silverstein, so what's your connection to the sport of soccer? Did you play the sport? Have you been a fan of the sport? Tell them.
Well, you know, I'm a lifelong fan, of course. I played when I was very young. I had aspirations of being a goalkeeper, although I wasn't terribly good, I must be honest. When my family moved to Florida when I was pretty young, Florida in the mid-90s was very, very baseball-focused, so I became a very, you know, serious baseball player, and that actually turned out that was where my athletic talent was strongest. But I've been a long time soccer fan, and I'm excited now for the kids who are, you know, 8, 10, 12, 15 today, that soccer is, it's a real option for them to focus on and make it their primary sport. That was, you know, not so much the case for me when I was growing up. It was, of course, available, but you know, almost everyone that I know who has kids and teenagers, soccer is their principal interest and the main sport that they grew up playing, which I think is just absolutely fantastic. And I'm honestly a little jealous.
Now, you're in Portland, Oregon.
Yes.
What made you decide to get involved with the Houston Dynamo and Houston Dash here across the country?
Well, you know, I'm a huge believer in Major League Soccer and in the Dynamo specifically. Gabrielle Brenner, our lead owner, is a dear friend, and he's, you know, as of course you know, he's been part owner of the Dynamo for about 7 years. I've always thought that it was, you know, a wonderful organization, and I've been a big supporter of it because of the friendship with Gabrielle. And when he called us early in the summer, And invited us to participate in the acquisition of the majority shares from AEG, we were just delighted and so excited to be part of something something so special, and to be able to partner with Gabrielle on something of this kind of significance was a total dream come true.
He's Jake Silverstein joining us, one of the new Dynamo owners here, joining us here on Soccer Matters, ESPN 97.5. Look, you've been in Portland. I mean, you've seen this whole just love affair with the Portland Timbers and the years of keeping that name alive. And, I mean, that even goes back to the 80s when I was playing professionally. I mean, Portland has done an amazing job of keeping that name alive and the history of the pro game in that city. But when you see Merritt Paulson and you see what the Portland Timbers have done and what a local guy on the ground can achieve with his connection and hands-on approach, just kind of take us through what you've seen occur there. I know these are very differing markets, but, boy, what a remarkable environment it's been up in Portland.
Oh, yeah. I mean, the Timbers ownership group and management have done an incredible job of really, you know, building wonderful support and spirit in the community. Portland, of course, is, you know, it's a very unique demographic here. Only two, you know, major sports franchises, the Timbers and the Blazers, of course, and the demographic tends to be pretty young. There are a lot of millennials, a lot of transplants who've moved here recently. So of course, it's a very unique market, but I think they've done a really extraordinary job of making the Timbers, you know, Portland's team and sort of the heart and soul of the sporting community here, and engaging a lot of folks who I think may not have even been soccer or sports fans beforehand, just getting swept up in Timber spirit. And I think, you know, I think we have the same opportunity to create something similar in Houston. Houston, of course, a much larger city, you know, super vibrant, growing so fast, all kinds of different demographics, plus, you know, every major sport represented, lots of competition for people's attention with the, you know, the NFL and the Rockets and the Astros. So certainly it's a different animal, but I think that the Timbers are one of the excellent examples of, you know, how to really engage a community and you know, build soccer fever and MLS fever in a town. So congratulations to them, of course.
Yeah, no doubt about it. It's been a great environment. I've been there. You talked about, in an interview, the authentic soccer experience mm-hmm. that you feel comes through Major League Soccer and that rivals any other sports experience in America. Take me into the authenticity of soccer that Jake Silverstein likes about this sport and about this league.
Well, I think, you know, my oldest brother has lived in London for almost my entire life, and he and his son are and have been for a very long time diehard Crystal Palace fans. And when they came over to watch a Dynamo game with us this summer, they were amazed at how alive and vibrant the environment was. You know, as lifelong Premier League fans, they hadn't paid as much attention to MLS, you know, as I have and we do here, but they were totally impressed with the commitment and the fan base and the energy. And, you know, coming from Crystal Palace fans who have some of the most active supporters in the Premier League, I thought that was a great, you know, endorsement and vote of confidence. I think going to a soccer game fundamentally feels different from going to a basketball game or a football game. The particular ways in which the crowd is engaged, the history of singing, holding up the scarves, so many of these things that we have inherited from the European traditions and then have really been starting to grow and blossom with their own local and unique flavor in the MLS. Is really, you know, something wonderful to behold and great to be a part of.
So you as a younger guy now, I mean, do you want your vision and your ideas heard? How's that going to work? Because in some ways, you know, you've got Mr. Brenner with 51% of the controlling interest of the club. You've got the De La Hoya group. I mean, how active will you be, Jake? Is that to be determined? How active do you want to be? Because a 30-year-old who loves sports in this country and an intelligent one at that, like you, I'm sure you got some very good ideas.
Well, you know, I don't know how good my ideas are. I guess that's to be determined, but I'm certainly very excited to participate in all the ways that I can. You know, I think that Gabrielle has done an amazing job of putting together an excellent ownership group. Mr. Ben Gwill is a very impressive and wonderfully heartfelt, sincere, kind man. And I believe that, you know, that all of us bring different perspectives and different skill sets, and that hopefully together we're going to, you know, help empower Chris Kennedy and the rest of the organization to, you know, really give Houston the MLS team and culture that it deserves.
Yeah, and you mentioned, you know, all the other competition, very differing market than Portland, all these other sports, lifestyle. You know, we've got the NFL, the NBA, Major League Baseball here. There's all these challenges. There always will be. Competition will be there on a daily basis. How do you think Houston and the Dynamo become more relevant in this city?
Well, I believe that Chris and Matt and Owen have a real vision for what they want the Dynamo's playing style to be like. Of course, I'm not, you know, I don't add any value being in the weeds like that in terms of the specific strategy or player acquisition, but I really believe that they have an excellent vision for how to make the team gel and come together for this next season in a way that's going to be really, really exciting. And just, you know, by virtue of having a team that is playing well, I think that'll help build some excitement. And I believe that the new ownership and the changeover will probably be important as well in thinking through some new ways to engage millennials and, you know, other. Sorry, did I say something?
No, you're good.
Oh, sorry.
Yeah. No.
I think we're thinking through all the different ways that we can work to engage with different fan bases and, you know, really make Houston a super soccer town.
Yeah, I think people are very interested, too, because the playing style is changing and the team's going to, you know, for quite some time has not really played with an out-and-out playmaker, which that's obviously going to happen. Owen Coyle and Matt have talked so much about the wide game, and that's a piece that they want to bring to the table to widen the game out and provide more penetration out there. So I think you're right, the purpose of play, and that's going to be a big piece in the future. And to me, playing styles can attract fans.
Absolutely. I think you see that in all the sort of professional sports in this country. You know, a lot of times when a team is playing well or when they're doing something interesting, whether it's having one dominant player or a beautiful, well-oiled functioning system, you know, it's a great way to get people engaged. It's always fun to see your team do well.
Jake, listen, we first of all, thank you very much for coming on. And first night we introduce you via ESPN Radio here to all the soccer fans in Houston. We look forward to your visit here. We hope you get healthy real soon. Have a great Christmas. And we look forward to having you on again.
Thanks for having me. And I'll see you in Houston. You know, I'll be there a lot.
Sounds good. Let us know when you're coming in. We'll bring you in studio. Okay?
Okay, thanks.
All right, that's Jake Silverstein, one of the new owners of the Houston Dynamo. Man, young guy, a lot going on there with him. It's going to be great to have him a part of the Dynamo now in the future. We will take a quick break here. It's a 7-Up break.
ESPN 97.5. Please stand by. You are listening to Soccer Matters on ESPN 97.5. From the Gao Studios in Houston, here's Glenn Davis.
All right, welcome back to Soccer Matters here on ESPN 97.5. Joining us now is a frequent guest on the show, World Soccer Talks, Steve Davis, clearly for me one of the best writers about the game of soccer here in the United States. Steve, thank you very much for coming on the show as usual.
The check's in the mail, as always, for saying all those nice things.
The Mutual Admiration Society that we're a part of. All right.
Thanks for having me on.
No, but I do mean what I said. So 4 weeks ago, you did a great piece here. I love this. The title of the piece was Old Rules about foreign coaches may not apply to our new MLS. And basically, you make the point here that, you know, in the past, we should there was some sense of, you know, you got to go American, you got to understand the league, you got to know the league. But as the league blossoms now, and you know, there's thought that this league is going to go to, what, 28 teams down the road, there are some hires, clearly, that are very interesting, that are foreign, that are, from a stylistic and purpose of play standpoint, something that makes the league and the game interesting. So as much as people can say, Steve, that Patrick Vieira, boy, is he going to struggle with MLS, or Owen Coyle is, or Veljko Panovic in Chicago, these are very interesting hires because soccer fans are going to want to see if these guys can produce in a league where foreign managers, quite frankly, have had little success.
Yeah, and it is really interesting. That was one of the points I was making, that as Major League Soccer evolves, you know, we don't always quite know what's coming. I suppose, you know, you kind of look at some kid maybe that's 10 or 12 years old. You get some idea of what he's gonna be like, but you don't really know, do you? You don't know if he's gonna develop a taste for the arts, or if he's gonna develop a, you know, all of a sudden somebody's got to figures out he's got a 95 mile per hour fastball. You just don't know. We don't know about Major League Soccer. We have an idea, but man, the Major League Soccer of 10 years ago really bears very little resemblance to the Major League Soccer of today. So, you know, whereas the patterns became a little predictable in 2005 and 2006, and then on through the next few years, Major League Soccer diversified, the styles diversified, the way the clubs manage their personnel diversified, and therefore I think it's okay that now we look at the managers and say there's going to be a diversity of managers. You know, at a place like Dallas, they need a guy like Oscar Pereja, who's great at working with kids, right? He's great at working with young players. You know, a place like L.A., where you're going to have to do a little more ego management, you know, who knows if Oscar Pereja would work there? Who knows if Bruce Arena would work in a place where you got to develop a few more youth? So, yeah, I just think that there are some interesting hires. Before, I would have hired, I would have panned a hire like they made in Chicago, but the guy there has some skins on his wall with youth. So we just have to wait and see. Even Patrick Vieira, I have my doubts, because I don't know if this is kind of a place he wants to be, or if it's just a way station for him. But we have to wait and see, don't we?
Well, let's go through them one by one. But before you get there, I mean, I don't think there's any question that I think managers more now than ever in Major League Soccer are going to have to continue to trend with the changing style and the amoeba-like movement of the league. Things are changing. This is not the same league as when there were 10 teams back in 2006.
Yeah, and I'll tell you what, something that maybe we don't talk enough about, Glenn, and guys like you and I probably should talk about this a little bit more. It's not just the manager, is it? You know, it's getting that right player personnel guy, and then the way they work in unison. You know, the player personnel guy has to understand, you know, the technical director or whatever the title they're calling it, director of football operations, has to understand what kind of style the coach wants to play. You know, does the technical director have to go out and get a right back and a left back who can bomb up and down and who can put in a good serve from different places? Or is the manager, does he like fullbacks that are a little bit more stay-at-home guys, just good one-on-one defenders, solid, you know, solid, easy choices out of the back, that kind of thing. So that's just one little example. Or is it that the technical director has to appoint a certain style of coach to play a certain style because that's the kind of players that he wants to play, and he's been given a directive to, you know, go play this style so they can put, you know, butts in the seat. I don't know. I'm just kind of picking things out of the air here. But my point is, it's not just the managers that have to evolve. It's the technical directors. And by the way, the salary cap rules in this league, as we saw recently, they just keep getting more complex. So they not only have to be able to work these different styles and appoint and find the right players, they got to make sure they're way on top of their game as far as understanding how to work these salary cap rules and how to make them work.
You know, let me take you back, because I think you just brought something up very interesting. the technical director, the slash sporting director, and then the manager of the team. I think it's very nebulous all around the league as to, you know, is it the coach or the manager reporting to the sporting director? Are they supposedly working side by side? Who has the final call on things? This is very interesting because that relationship has to work between those two people. I don't think there's any question. And if, you know, is it the manager saying, look, here's the system we're playing based on these reasons, and this is sort of also in some way helping with the identity of the type of team we want in our market, whether it's a Houston, which is very different from Portland, which is very different from maybe a New York Red Bulls. So I think that whole sporting technical director slash combination relationship with manager is really interesting because I don't think we know in a lot of cases how that sort of structure works. You know, who's got the final say?
Yeah, to build on what you're saying, Glenn, you're absolutely right. We don't know. But think about this, just to build on what you're saying. 5 years ago, maybe a little bit, going a little further back, maybe 6-7 years ago, a lot of teams, maybe the majority of teams, didn't have that position. It did. 10 years ago, I'd say, maybe one or two teams did, and that was it. So we're really still in the early stages of that position as these clubs matured as organizations. For a while, it was just the manager making most of the personnel calls, kind of working them through his general manager. But a lot of times, the general manager was really a guy who was just more in charge of the office and making sure that the ticketing and the marketing and the PR and all that was sorted out. He wasn't really a soccer guy so much. Then people started hiring slowly technical directors or director of football operations. But again, not everybody had one until. Really, I guess it was about 5 years ago that most of the teams had one. But even then, to your point, the relationships continue to evolve. We don't know. Well, we know, for instance, in a place like L.A., Bruce Arena makes the calls. We know that for sure. But in most places, we don't really know who makes all the calls.
Yeah, no, I don't think there's any question. I mean, even the Dynamo here went to a different model finally. You know, Dominic Kinnear was a former manager, made all the player selections and decisions ultimately, and now the Dynamo finally came to the point where they've got a sporting director in Matt Jordan. And look, I think in order to be competitive in the future, you have to have more eyeballs on it. You have to have more people doing things. I think you have to have an intricate player database and scouting system. And I mean, these are all things that can give you a competitive edge.
Yeah, no question. And again, even if you have those things, you might have a manager who's got enough skins on the wall, like a Bruce Arena, who will still make the ultimate decisions. But yeah, you're absolutely right. If you don't have that guy overseeing some type of scouting network, which I think will become increasingly sophisticated, overseeing those the databases, as you said, and overseeing your now more and more important. The academy systems, the youth development systems, you've got to have those positions because, you know, old Bruce Arena, as good as he is, you know, he can't do all the legwork. He can make the big calls on whether or not, you know, if somebody presents him the next Steven Gerrard, he can make the call saying, no, he fits or he doesn't fit. He will be the big voice there, but he's got to have guys going out and doing all the legwork on the front end, and then he just comes in and makes the big decision.
So let's talk about the Chicago Fire hire and Veljko Panovich, who I think is very interesting. In your article, as you mentioned, and many people know this, he won the FIFA Under 20 World Cup with Serbia, with the Serbian Under 20s. I mean, this is an incredible feat he's done. So Veljko Panovich goes to Chicago. Your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I wonder about it. As I said, three or four or 5 years ago, I would have looked at that and said, "What are they doing?" Now I'm at least, you know, willing to not make that quick, not that kind of a snap judgment on it because he does have this experience working with youth, and maybe that's the model they want to go after. I will say this: he did play in Major League Soccer, and that helps, but he didn't play a lot, and I still wonder. Now you've got two things working against him: he's still a young guy. And as you know, Glenn, problem solving in any at any managerial level, really in any sport, not just, you know, you look at the New York Giants today. They got a big problem with their star player right now, who's going to get suspended. You know, any level, you got to be a problem solver. So there's one thing. And now Major League Soccer presents its own unique set of problems: the travel, the time zone switches, all of those salary cap rules that have to be managed. And you just look at it and you say, well, there are really good people out there. Kerry Zavagnin, that I know, interviewed for that job. I think somebody's going to give him his chance at some point. And you just wonder if maybe it would have been better to go with somebody with a little bit more experience in Major League Soccer. But at least they didn't go the old route, which they had done before, and kind of make the safe choice. And I did like that they kind of went a little more bold and didn't just get the next Frank Klopas, who has had success at some point in the past, but has kind of seems like maybe it's passed them by a little bit.
Well, that, I think you just hit the nail on the head. Without these clubs like the Fire, like New York City FC, making moves that are interesting, some might call them sexy, very different. Veljko Panovic in Chicago, in New York City, with New York City FC, and Patrick Vieira. I think it's fascinating. From a fan who doesn't have a dog in the fight and you're on the outside looking in, I think it's absolutely fascinating. I think it's essential that people are taking risks with foreign coaches to complement the American one. Steve, a great piece. It's World Soccer Talk. It's called Old Rules About Foreign Coaches May Not Apply to Our New MLS. It's Steve Davis. Get over to World Soccer Talk. That is where you can get all of his great pieces. Steve, as always, thank you very much. Happy holidays, and thank you for coming on the program.
Man, Merry Christmas and happy holidays, and thanks for having me on. I always love talking soccer with you.
So that's it. We wrap it up in style here tonight. World Soccer Talk, Steve Davis, extremely good writer, one that brings up some very, very good topics. As always, my thanks to producers David Philpott, Tyler Scott here tonight for getting me on the air, helping me with interviews, and all the great work they do to help make this show a success. You can follow me at Twitter, Glenn Davis Sock, Facebook, Soccer Matters. Hope you have a great rest of the evening. Good night, everyone.
ESPN 97.5.